from UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation. This is Tales from the South, recorded in front of a live audience at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas. Each week, it's an intimate dinner with everyday Southerners on our unrehearsed show, telling their story as if they were sitting on the porch with you. So sit back, relax, and reconnect with the power of a story. Now, let's go live to Tales from the South.
So happy that I can't sit down.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Tyrannosaurus Chicken? What y'all think? Y'all enjoy? They have CDs for sale after the show, and you can hear more from them on Facebook. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator tonight and every night, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark wrote our theme music and is here each week. And how about our set back here? What do y'all think about our set? These genuine screen doors with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? On tonight's show, our writers find themselves in the middle of contests, some planned, some accidental, and some they knew nothing about. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Charlie Baxter's dad comes up with a contest to stop the bickering. And we'll end the night with Hank Godwin as he unwittingly finds himself in the middle of a competition he has no way of winning. But let's start the night with Pat Gillum as he and his competitor attempt to one-up each other for the biggest catch in The King of Fayetteville.
The year was 1968, and I just turned 24. I was flipping through the paper one day when I stopped on a picture of an old man with what looked to me like, at the time, an unbelievably large string of catfish. Caption under the picture was, "Dick Dyer does it again." Seems Dick Dyer was about the best catfisherman around Fayetteville, Arkansas. I wished I could do that, but that seemed beyond my reach. When I was a kid, growing up in Wing, Arkansas, I caught lots of catfish, and boy, we needed them. They sure tasted good after a diet of salt pork. But they weren't real big. In the early days at Fayetteville, I had access to larger rivers, and I thought more and more about catfishing. Well, as it happened, shortly after seeing that newspaper article, my wife Barbara and I moved over to Anderson Place. Would you care to guess who my neighbor right across the street was? You guessed it, Dick Dyer. I befriended him. I cultivated him. I quizzed him. After a while, Dick's M.O. began to emerge. I studied his techniques. He even let me go fishing with him one time. Well, he began to see that I could be a competitor somewhere down the line, and Dick just dearly relished being the best river catfish catcher around. Maintaining that status consumed his whole life. He pretty well cut me off from any more information. But I knew enough. I began to catch more and more fish using his methods. Well, Dick was okay with that because he was still catching more fish than me and bigger fish. Now, we went along there, him doing just a little bit better for several years. Then I slowly began to catch as many fish as he did, and probably about the same in total weight. He still had the largest fish, 16 pounds. Every time he saw me, he told me about that 16-pound catfish. He just never let me forget about that 16-pound catfish. Barbara and I were coming into the last months at Fayetteville for us. One really deep hole that I fished a time or two that spring with my limb lines probably tied to limbs that I know now were too solid with very little give just kept breaking. The lines were 120-pound test or so, and I couldn't understand that at the time. Barbara and I were walking along the riverbank one day in June on a picnic. I saw two old watermelon rinds just lying up on the bank, and they were just covered with hundreds of June bugs. I had never heard of anyone using a June bug to catch catfish, but I did know that in the late summer, they often fed by just skimming along the surface and picking up floating bugs, whatever they could find. I'd seen them doing that. After Barbara had walked on toward the car, I went back, pitched the rinds in the river, and the June bug just all floated up. I just scooped them up, put them in a paper bag, stuck them in the car. When we got home, I wrapped them up really tight in a freezer bag and stuck them way back in the back of the freezer, pretty well out of sight. Barbara just put no stock in mixing fish bait and food in the freezer. Late in the summer, I was watching TV one day, and I heard Barbara scream. I ran to the kitchen. There she was, the bag in one hand, a handful of June bugs in the other. Seems she had just been going through freezer bags, trying to find something to cook, stuck her hand in, and pulled out the June bugs. Boy, I caught it good over that. But as Barbara settled down some a little bit later, I said, I've just got time for one more fishing trip before we move, and there's just no telling when I'll get to go fishing again. I'll get every one of those June bugs out of here then. She agreed. You catch Barbara when she's not screaming with a handful of June bugs, and she's a great gal. Next week rolled around. I asked John Philpott if he wanted to go with me. Said, oh, I guess so. I got nothing better to do. We went back to that hole where the White River and the West Fork of the White River join and where my lines had been broken last spring. This time, I had a new idea. We were fishing with cane poles, very limber, and we stuck them way, way back up in that mud bank. I floated each hook right on top of the water, each one with a June bug on it. We ran the lines at midnight and had a couple of 10-pounders and a whole passel of smaller catfish. But right there where the two rivers join, that pole was going absolutely crazy. You ever try to get a lively 25-pound catfish in a little bitty landing net? Well, we finally did. The next morning, we ran them again, and we had a couple more 10-pounders and a bunch of smaller catfish. Then we approached that last hole, right where the two rivers join. That pole was completely out of the bank, but it was still laying there, mostly out of the water, and lying in the water, either just too worn out for one more flip of the tail, or having learned from his struggles that that was as far as he could go, was the brother of the last one, and he was 25 pounds. Well, when I got home, needless to say, the first thing I did was take him over to Dick Dyer. Dick came out. I held him up as well as I could. That's pretty heavy. I didn't say a thing. I didn't have to. I held him up. Dick never said a word to me either. He just turned sort of sick looking, turned around, dropped his head, and walked back in the house. We moved to Hannibal, Missouri a couple days later, and I never saw Dick again. About 2 weeks after we got to Hannibal, a letter chock full of pictures arrived. A 40-pound catfish and a whole bunch in the 20-pound range. The letter just verified the weights, and in the picture, an old man was smiling. Smiling right straight out at me. That's all. Not another word. The return name on the envelope was Dick Dyer. Well, I knew Dick didn't have my address, but some way he had managed to find it. And some way, I knew also that he had found my glory hole. All I could figure out was he must have ragged John Philpott into telling him. I was pretty put out by this whole thing for a while. Then after I settled down some, I began to think about it a little differently. I'd used Dick's methods, developed through his many years of experience. He used me to locate the glory hole. Fair's fair. I've never been back to that glory hole, but someday I will. Over the years, I think I've figured it out. There's a dam on the White River a quarter mile upstream. Catfish naturally swim upstream until they're stopped by a dam. The small fish stay there in that shallow hole at the dam, and the big fish, they must have deep water, and they go back downriver only as far as they need to the first very deep hole, right where the two rivers join in the glory hole. And there they still lie, year after year after year, just getting bigger and bigger and bigger, just waiting for me to come back and challenge them again. But Dick Dyer passed away many years ago, and when he died, he was still the king of the catfish catchers in Fayetteville, and it just wouldn't be the same. Who else in the world could care as much about the size of the catfish I might catch there as Dick Dyer did? Nobody, that's who. For all you catfishermen out there, I know you can find my glory hole from what I told you here, but where are you going to find a handful of June bugs?
Pat Gillum is a teacher raised in Mountainous Wing, Arkansas. He has been married to Barbara 45 years and has 2 children and 5 grandchildren. He writes a blog, Forever a Hillbilly, and is currently writing his 2nd book, Spreading Wing. In our next story, Charlie Baxter's dad attempts to quiet the rivalry with an interesting contest in The Race to Be the Boss.
It was the summer of 1954 in Mountains, Arkansas. We were in the middle of corn cob wars, cotton bowl wars, dirt clod wars, and BB gun wars. We fought Indians and we played Tarzan. We had an array of animals, horses, chickens, calves, a pet fox, an armadillo, a squirrel, a rabbit, a mule, and 7 dogs and 13 cats. I was 6 years old, my brother was 10, and my sister was 13, and they were exactly equal. They each could throw a curveball, they could hit the ball over the fence, they could drive a tractor and a truck, and they fought all the time. They fought over who would walk down to get the mail, who would sit in the front seat of the truck, who got the biggest piece of pie. It was endless, and my dad had had enough. A couple of years before, my dad, an excellent farmer, a fine cattleman with the slickest, fattest herd of polled Herefords in Greene County, an acceptable Sunday school teacher, a decent song leader at Mounds Baptist Church, made the 3 acres in front of our house the original field of dreams. It was 400 feet from our front porch to the gravel road where our mailbox was. Our driveway was the eastern boundary, the gravel road the southern boundary, and the bean field was the western boundary of this 3 acres. This was a baseball field in the summer, a basketball football field in the fall. We did track and field in the spring, and in the winter, we built snowmen there when it snowed. We practiced casting our rods and reels there. We practiced shooting our guns. We wrestled and we fought. And when the time was right, we rode a homemade sleigh behind the tractor until we just froze to death. We also had fireworks there on holidays. Our baseball field was the community baseball field. We had regulation bases. The backstop was made of chicken wire, bases of burlap feed bags, and a regulation pitcher's mound. And we kept that field drug real smooth. Every Sunday, the whole community came to our house to play baseball. Later, I realized that my dad had done this to make sure that he could see what we were doing and make sure that he kept control of any temptations that might come our way. This day, as I said, Dad had had enough of Becky and Bill's arguing. He decided to have a race. The winner would be the boss for the rest of the summer. It might sound trivial to you, but it was a really big deal. Dad was known all over the county for his schemes. One day, when snow blanketed our whole farm, Dad told me and Bill, if you run around the house naked 3 times in the first snow of the year, you'll never get sick. My mother said, oh, Archie. It was too late. Bill had pulled his tighty-whities off, was headed out the door, and I was right behind him. Out we went out the back door, naked as jaybirds. Not a stitch, no shoes, nothing. We headed around the back of the house and toward the west wall between the propane tank and the mulberry tree and headed for the front of the house. I was so cold. I didn't want to miss the cure. We rounded the corner of the house, racing to the front porch, and Mother came out and grabbed us, took us in the front door. We were frozen. My feet hurt so badly I was shivering, and Bill was so cold his teeth just chattered. Mother wrapped us in quilts and set us by the stove. "Archie, you should be ashamed of yourself," she said with as much disgust as I'd heard at that time in my life. Dad said, "Well, don't blame me if you get sick." And he went out to feed the cows. Now back to this hot summer day. I followed Becky and Bill and Dad out to the baseball field. Dad laid out the rules. Becky would start at home plate, run the bases the usual way, from first to second to third and back home plate. Bill would run backwards, third to second, then first and back home. The first one to arrive at home plate was the boss for the rest of the summer. Dad drilled it in, the boss, the person that made all the decisions. They each put a foot on home plate, and Dad said, "One, two, three, go." And they were off like the wind. Becky headed toward first base and Bill toward third. It was difficult to see which one of them touched their respective bases first. They headed for second. I did say they were equal, didn't I? With every muscle of their body, they ran as hard as they could toward second base. Nothing was more important than getting to home plate first. They each made their last step toward second base, each thinking the other would flinch or dodge or slow up. They didn't. Becky's left foot hit second base at exactly the same time Bill's right foot hit. Their bodies met squarely. Their shoulders, stomachs, legs, arms, heads met exactly on second base. It was frightening. Becky fell backwards toward right field. Bill fell backwards toward left field. For a moment, there was silence as they lay on the ball field. Dad said, "Oh, no." We started toward them. I was right behind him. All of a sudden, as if the two of them had been hit with an electric shock, they realized they could still win this race. Both sprang to their feet. Becky headed toward third. Bill headed toward first. The race was back on. They had engaged the enemy again. The battle could still be won. Dad turned back toward home plate, and as they touched third and first, respectively, he realized they were again in a dead heat. If something wasn't done, they'd collide at home plate. Dad said, "Grab Becky. Don't let her get to home plate." About 6 feet from home plate, I made a football tackle on my sister. I hit her right at the waist and held on for dear life. As we rolled on the ground, I saw Dad had his hands under Bill's shoulders. Bill's feet were off the ground, still running. Both Becky and Bill were swinging their arms and trying to fight us off to get to home plate, but neither one did. As the energy died down, there they were, both sweaty and dirty, with dried blood on Bill's nose and a knot on Becky's forehead the size of an egg. All four of us walked back to the house. Mother really didn't say a thing. She just announced that supper would be ready in 10 minutes. That meant to Becky and Bill, "You better get cleaned up and ready." Dad hustled off and got cleaned up too. We used lots of ways to settle arguments after that day. We stood on our heads. We shot BB guns at small objects. We flipped coins, but never again did we have a race to see who was the boss.
Charlie Baxter is the director of the Hayes Center in North Little Rock, Arkansas. He is an avid traveler, juggler, songwriter, gardener, painter, and maker of fused glass jewelry. He and his wife, Carol, have a dog named Molly. In our final story of the night, Hank Godwin's peaceful afternoon is suddenly changed as he realizes he has a formidable opponent in the game.
I was several hours into my 55-plus hour weekend with my nephew, Andrew, when I saw him cut his eyes away from his favorite Backyardigan video and straight at me. And in that flash of a moment, I realized with crystal clarity that I was in the middle of a game with him, and that he was sizing up me, his opponent, for the weekend. The game of cricket sometimes goes on for days. However, longevity and blunt instruments that might hurt you are the only things that cricket and my and Andrew's game had in common. Cricket is boring except for the most educated cricket fan. Boring never once entered my mind during our contest. Cricket is played in clean, crisply ironed white uniforms. Our game, not so much. Tees with familiar logos, sweatpants, pajamas, dirty tennis shoes, and jeans are all we wore in the tussle. Clean, we both soiled our uniforms multiple times during our breakneck-paced encounter. I had been asked to stay with Andrew and my only niece, Audrey, while my brother and sister-in-law took a well-deserved vacation. Audrey is easily categorized. She is highly engaged and overcommitted, bright high school student. She fills every second of her life with cheerleading, dance, soccer, music, church, and studying. My 12-year-old nephew, Andrew, is a little harder to describe. I believe most people would say he has special needs. He has some autistic traits, but his school probably insufficiently sizes him up as MR. I had clear instruction from his mother as to what to do over the weekend, but I was unprepared for Andrew's game. After the original sizing up, the rest of Saturday was fairly uneventful, broken up by the Hog basketball game on TV and a visit from Aunt Liza. He was extremely good. He filled the rest of the evening with our second favorite video, Underdog, and it was bath time. I had an inkling that the pace of our game was about to pick up. Audrey came running down the stairs to the master bath from practicing the guitar in her room. She had heard my ascending crescendo of no through the vents. Andrew was standing buck naked in the tub, relieving himself in the bathwater. He looked like a chiseled marble Greek god positioned in the middle of a Grecian fountain. The only difference was he was laughing almost as hard as I was. It was a funny sight. I was laughing hysterically right up to the point where I realized I couldn't give my nephew a bath in the toilet bowl. I tried to drain the tub, not knowing how to shut off the fountain. Obviously, a stern and ever volume increasing no was not working. Nephews should come with a shut-off switch like are installed in boats for when you get thrown out. Andrew, 10. Uncle Hank, 0. Andrew is an eating machine. I could see it in Audrey's eyes when I asked if he liked chicken fingers. It was a look that said, just keep your fingers and toes away from his mouth and you won't be injured. However, I was quite proud of myself by serving a salad with oranges, some fancy salad dressing from the darkest corner of the refrigerator, and some chopped chicken fingers. I believe Audrey was also impressed in light of the fact that I had filled their trash with McDonald's, Sonic, and Taco Bell sacks by this time. I did not cave in to Andrew's favorite fast food. Score one for me. This was a great moral victory within the big game. Andrew 10, Uncle Hank 1. However, Andrew scored at will during dinner. It is amazing that neither Audrey nor I got hurt. It is more amazing that we somehow salvaged some nourishment, albeit salad. I don't really consider salad real food, but it was the sacrifice I made for my favorite niece. Andrew 14, Uncle Hank 1. Similar to a hockey game, I think we were playing 3 periods. We had finished 2 by Saturday night. I spent my locker time sleeping that night. I'm now sure that Andrew lay awake creating the most awesome game plan for Sunday. Church was great, and he was excited that we were going to Home Depot afterwards to check out the weed eaters. He had demonstrated his skills on Saturday and, in fact, scored several unanswered points in our game by finding his way out of the backyard to make-believe trim the yards of both neighbors. Audrey saved me again with a lock for the gate. I really hadn't thought the Home Depot visit through. I, too, enjoy a visit to the depot. Liza has many times found me staring at miter saws and cordless tools. I could do it for hours. Andrew knew where to go and immediately made a beeline to the weed eaters. He stared for only a few seconds and then suddenly reached for the bright red box. I thought I was going to have to either buy it or get a crowbar to loosen his grip. I somehow convinced him that his daddy was much richer than his Uncle Hank. And the purchase of such a critical implement was an immediate family decision. The mention of more food from a local drive-thru was enough to break his focus. He willingly led me to the car. Andrew, 17, Uncle Hank, 1. Andrew had big plans for the final period of our game. I figured I would be a good brother-in-law if I did a load of dishes and laundry. This was the opening Andrew needed to widen an already insurmountable gap in the score. I swear it was only seconds that I had lost track of him. I was in the laundry room and sensed something was wrong. I immediately let out a cry, Andrew! I turned and there was Audrey. She must have sensed it also or was getting used to moving quickly down the steps to the sound of terror in my voice. I opened the kitchen door to the garage and my heart stopped. The outside garage door was up. Andrew had the keys in his hand and was sliding into the driver's seat. How could I possibly explain that to his mother? I think Audrey could tell I was shaken. It was probably my ghost-like complexion and slurred speech that gave it away. Andrew, however, calmly informed me he was moving the car to get the lawnmower out to mow the backyard. This seemed reasonable enough. I not so quickly extracted the wedge lawnmower from its storage place and escorted him to his job. Andrew, 20, Uncle Hank, 1. My heart and blood pressure were about to return to normal when I looked up and Andrew was marching through the den with a gas can. By now, Audrey was keeping an eye on me. I think she was afraid to leave her wonderful brother alone with her crazy uncle. I asked her if her parents let Andrew play with gas. I'm now sad that my favorite niece had to answer such an idiotic question. It should have been obvious, yet at this time, my confidence and game face were gone. Andrew, 24, Uncle Hank, 1. Audrey had no sooner returned the gas can to its proper place when Andrew again marched confidently through the den with 2 extension cords. Nothing gets by me. He was finished mowing, and it was time to trim. Again, I incorrectly surmised that this was harmless. There was no string in the Craftsman weed eater. What could happen? After the antique weed eater motor started smoking, I did have the sense to unplug it. I took some convincing, but I explained to Andrew that we didn't want to start a grass fire. Andrew, 30, Uncle Hank, 1. Just when I was about to search the medicine cabinets for something to calm my nerves, Andrew again cut his eyes towards me. I know he loves me dearly because at that moment he chose to watch Underdog again. Andrew looked at me, a beaten old man, and said, "Time to relax." They were sweet and welcome words. This meant we could each assume our positions on the 2 couches in the den. We only interrupted our nephew-uncle relaxing time with a final trip to another drive-up window. From time to time, I could catch him cutting his eyes towards me. I'm pretty sure he wasn't sizing me up anymore. He now knew the caliber of his conquered guest. Again, like a true sportsman, he was savoring his fun victory.
Hank Godwin is a longtime resident of North Little Rock and married to Liza, his wife of 35 years. He dedicates this story to his father-in-law, Dr. Max Thorne, who has played the game of life with great compassion and integrity. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? What'd y'all think? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. Studio time by Infrared Studio Productions. Graphics by Robin Steves at Studio B. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.